golfers, get ready to elevate your Saturday mornings. Yeah, it's Brian Murphy here, and I am thrilled to introduce the Clubhouse Corner with Ben and Eddie. This is a passion project from the good folks at the Clubhouse in Fremont. These two are on a mission to make golf accessible and enjoyable for the masses. So set your alarm. 7 a.m. every Saturday, join Ben and Eddie at the Clubhouse Corner, only on KNBR.
Fans, it's great to have you back here on this Sunday morning as we get ready for baseball. The Giants and the Padres wrap up this three-game series here on Mother's Day. It's a pleasure to bring in David Flights. David is a wonderful author. He's a web developer and database analyst who lives in Troy, Michigan. He's a longtime Sabre member. He's written nine other books on baseball history. The book that he wrote is Eddie Cicott. And I'll spell it for you. C-I-C-O-T-T-E. The Life and Career of the Banned Black Sox Pitcher. Now, before David starts to tell us about this story, if you saw the movie Eight Men Out or read the book Eight Men Out, of course, Eddie Cicott was the main pitcher for the White Sox who ended up with the bribe and through the World Series. But Eddie Cicott had a story of who he was and how that all came about and what happened in his later life. So most people look at the name and say, yeah, he's just one of the Black Sox. But Eddie Cicott has a very interesting background, and David Flights wrote about him. So, David, did I do well in explaining Eddie Cicott?
That sounds pretty good to me. That's yep, you did a good job.
Okay, very good. I'm going to let you take it from here. Eddie Cicott, of course, we used to call him Cicotti, but it is Cicott. Pitched for the White Sox, and let's talk about his career, what kind of guy he was, what kind of pitcher he was, and a lot of people say he was the first to throw the knuckleball.
Well, he was definitely the first to make a long career out of throwing the knuckleball. We don't know if he invented it. Sometimes he says he did, but he was certainly the first pitcher in baseball to make a long career out of throwing the knuckleball. He was the first one to control it well enough to do that. So when I'll tell you when his career started. He started it with the Detroit Tigers in 1905 when he was 21 years old. He pitched three games for the Tigers. They wound up letting him go, and he resurfaced 3 years later after he developed the knuckleball with the Boston Red Sox. Then after several years, up and down years with the Red Sox, he gets traded to the White Sox in the middle of that season in 1912, and that's where he became a star.
Now, he was not an overpowering pitcher. This, and again, we have this image of the World Series and Eddie Cicott. He was a slow ball pitcher, and he had the knuckleball. But he had a 29-game win season and other seasons like that.
Yes, he was only about 5'8.5" tall. There's a really wonderful picture in my book that shows the White Sox pitching staff, and he's almost half a head shorter than all the other ones. So Eddie was not a big guy. He had a very mediocre fastball. He was what we call a junk ball pitcher. And it wasn't just the knuckler either. He threw the slider and, of course, spitballs and shine balls and things that were legal then that aren't legal now. So he just threw all the junk he possibly could, and that's what made him a winner. I believe he was a 20-game winner four times with the White Sox.
So here we come to 1919, and of course this is the movie, the book, and your book is the trilogy for me because there's such good information in here. So here we come to 1919. We know a little bit about Eddie. He's a slow ball pitcher. He's worked his way up. He throws all sorts of different pitches. But what's going on with him personally? Why does he become sort of susceptible to what's going to happen in 1919?
Well, Eddie's coming toward the end of his career. In 1919, he was 35 years old, so he knows the good salary from baseball isn't going to last too much longer. He also, in his house in Detroit, he has 12 people living in that house. He and his wife and their three kids, I believe his wife's parents were living there. His brother-in-law and his family were living there. They had 12 people in the house. So Eddie bought this farm outside of Detroit near Farmington. If you know the Detroit area, you'll probably know where that is, a little west of Detroit. And the farm had a mortgage on it that he wanted to pay off. So Eddie had a lot of financial pressures right about this time when he knows that his career is going to be ending soon. And Eddie was not well educated, as most of the Black Sox weren't. Eddie had left school at age 12 to go to work after his father passed away. So he knew the good times weren't going to last, and he had some financial pressures.
Well, we know that the gamblers, Sport Sullivan, Arnold Rothstein, people like that were involved in the bribe and fixing the World Series. But Eddie did something that was very smart, at least for him, and that is he said, look, I want my money in advance because I'm the key guy in this World Series, and if I'm going to participate with you guys, I want my $10,000 right now. And he got it.
Well, he was the oldest of the Black Sox, and he was probably the savviest, too. And, of course, he, like all ball players, had a lot of contact with gamblers and sporting types and bookies and all that kind of thing. And Eddie knew that the way to get your money is to get it in advance, and promises aren't worth anything. So he was the guy who got his he offered to throw the first game of the World Series for $10,000 payable in advance, and he got it, too.
Mm. So what happens? Of course, we know the Cincinnati Reds become the betting favorite, so to speak. You know, so much money is bet on the Reds, and they end up winning the World Series 5-3 out of, because it was a 9-game World Series. So what happens to Eddie afterwards? Of course, they reveal the bribe at the end of the next season, 1920. But what happens to Eddie in that season and later life?
Well, in 1920, the White Sox, one of the eight men out, Chick Gandel, decides to retire because he apparently took a lot of money home with him. But Eddie and the other six guys continue with the White Sox for 1920, and they were in the race against the Yankees and the Indians for most of the season. But in late August and early September, they lost 7 games in a row, totally unexpectedly, and dropped into second place, and they could never make it up. So they wound up losing the pennant by, I believe, 2 games. But in the very last week of the 1920 season is when the whole scandal blew up, and Eddie and the other six players were all suspended for the last couple games of the season.
Well, Eddie makes a statement, a full statement, and, of course, he's indicted. And then he goes to trial, and they're acquitted. But Judge Landis says, I don't care if you guys are acquitted. You fix the World Series, you'll never play again. And he's banished from baseball. So what happens to him in later life? He couldn't play anymore in what we call organized baseball.
Right. He couldn't play anymore in the major leagues, though he probably would have had a few good seasons left, though he was 36 years old by this time. So what he and some of the other Black Sox did, they formed a touring team, and they went out and played in dusty little towns on fields with very patchy grass and no clubhouse. And they went from small town to small town playing the locals and making a few $100 here or maybe $50 there doing that, just chasing games. It was almost certainly a really difficult life to live after having played on the very top level of baseball. Mm. So Eddie did that for a couple of years. And one problem was that the commissioner, Judge Landis, had threatened to ban any players who played against the Black Sox. Whether he could have actually done that, I don't know, but he threatened to permanently ban anyone who played against the Black Sox. So any young player who wanted a future in baseball was going to be afraid to play against them. That made finding games very, very difficult.
Mm. David Fleitz is the author, F-L-E-I-T-Z. The book is Eddie Cicotte, C-I-C-O-T-T-E. You can get it up in Montclair at the Book Tree. David can order it for you. It's McFarlane Publishing. It's a wonderful story. And I said it goes with the movie and the Eight Men Out book. And this is the third part to give you really the background of the key guy, the key pitcher. Imagine that, the key pitcher who was involved with throwing the World Series. David, as a last thought, and the book really, as I said, is a great historical vehicle for learning about all this stuff. Did Eddie ever make public statements later in life as he got older that this is what I did and I'm sorry or anything like that?
Well, just a few times. There was an interview. The last chapter of my book has his last interview. It was with Joe Falls of the Detroit Free Press. And Falls went to his farm in Farmington, Michigan to visit with him. Eddie was past 80 by this time. And he was living on this farm and growing strawberries and selling them at the roadside stand and watching the Tigers on TV and listening to them on the radio because the Tigers were his first major league team. But Eddie told Joe Falls that, yes, we did wrong, but I think I've lived a pretty good life, and I think a lot of other people have done wrong things in their lives too. He said, I think my family is proud of me. So he was kind of rationalizing it that way. He said, if I was crooked in one thing, other people are crooked in other things too.
Well, he's a 29-game winner in 1919, a 29-game winner, and he was a knuckleballer. One last aside on this thing, one of his teammates was Frank Schellenbach. And, of course, Frank Schellenbach became the pitching coach for Leo Durocher with the New York Giants. And why was it important? Well, Frank Schellenbach had a long minor league career, won about 300 games in the minor leagues, and he threw the spitball. And it just dawned on me, gee, Leo Durocher had Frank Schellenbach as his pitching coach, and he had Sal Magley and Larry Jansen and all these pitchers, and he won the pennant in 1951 and 54. I wonder what Frank Schellenbach taught the pitchers in the 50s. So we can't answer it, but it does come up in the book that Frank Schellenbach, one of his teammates, was a spitball pitcher who ended up in the minor leagues. David, I love the book. It's really good. I read the whole thing, and it's a good historical vehicle to find out about the band Black Sox, but especially about the major guy, the big pitcher, the guy who it had to go through Eddie Seacott to make it happen. So I appreciate you being on.
Well, thank you very much. I like talking about Eddie because one thing I found out is that I'm very distantly related to him. If you saw that in the introduction, I'm his third cousin three times removed. So there is a little tiny thread of a connection there.
Do you throw the knuckleball?
I threw the knuckleball in softball. I threw an underhanded knuckleball.
Okay,
and it was
all right.
Very difficult to do, too.
All right. Well, you did well for the family. David, thanks so much. Enjoy the day, and we're happy to have you on. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, more coming up, KNBR 104.5 and 680, the sports leader.
Hey, it's Brian Murphy here, and whether you're orchestrating a corporate gathering, gearing up for a team-building session, or just seeking a spot to savor thrilling sports and activities, the Clubhouse in Fremont is the go-to destination for bistro, bar, bocce, golf, and fitness. From team-building to private golf lessons on any one of 140 golf courses around the world, the Clubhouse in Fremont has you covered. Visit FremontClubhouse.com to learn more about their amazing amenities and private events. The Clubhouse in Fremont, the Bay Area's place to play.